Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Deep in the imagination, there's a crossroads, a space where curiosity and inspiration intersect and give birth to ideas. A space where music, science fiction, comic books, and pop culture inform the mind of what is and what could be. This is Jeff Boucher's Mind Space. In each episode, legendary journalist Jeff Boucher welcomes the biggest names in genre entertainment for an expansive dive into all things pop culture. Journey with Jeff as he explores the latest news and recommendations of the hottest releases across entertainment with his most trusted confidants. You are now entering deep space. Heavy Metal presents Jeff Boucher's Mind Space.
Hi, welcome to Mindspace. This is Jeff Boucher, and this week we're going to the intersection of Hollywood and Vine. We're going to do an entire show on Tarzan the Ape Man, and we have as our special guest, well, I'm here with Maya St. Clair, and we're here with our special guest, Michael Giltz. How are you, Mr. Giltz?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back on. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
It's great to have you on the show, and Michael, of course, is a veteran entertainment journalist and also... Yes, correct. And also, you can find his podcasting at Showbiz Sandbox. And you should do that directly and quickly because it's very, very good, very insightful. You know, the reason that I thought about talking about Tarzan today is because of Edgar Rice Burroughs. His birth date is coming up here in a couple of weeks. And I'm sort of fascinated by his career. I don't know. Do you know much about how he started, Michael?
I do. I've not read a biography of him, but I've read up on him, and I'm pretty familiar with him. He has a esteemed family lineage, goes back to the early days of the United States, traces all his family roots on both sides back to the British, and very proud of his name. In fact, the thing that amused me the most was that, you know, he struggled to do this, struggled to do that, and this didn't work, that didn't work. And at one point, he's a whole salesman of pencil sharpeners.
Yeah.
And that's what he's selling. And when he writes his first Pulp Fiction short story, because he says, I could write this junk, I could do better than this, he uses a pseudonym because he wants to protect his reputation. He's selling pencil sharpeners and he's worried about his reputation.
That's funny.
He wasn't a successful pencil sales sharpener, you know.
No. It's a dull job despite the job title. He was in Cincinnati, Ohio, I believe, and he was working at this wholesale pencil sharpener place, and he had salesmen who were out, and he was waiting for them to report back, and he would while away the hours by reading the magazines that the company had advertised in. It was part of their confirm their taxes and their revenues and expenses. They kept copies of the magazines that their ads sold those pencil sharpeners in, and he noticed that that these pulp magazines were, you needed more imagination than perhaps writing talent. And so he sat down and he decided to write himself an adventure, and two things came out. One was Tarzan the Ape Man, and the other would be known as eventually, you know, John Carter, Warlord of Mars, or by different titles, but Disney revisited as the film John Carter. And later he would do also, I think, The Land That Time Forgot and some other stuff, but primarily known for Tarzan. And what a phenomenal turn of events for this guy. So, like, as you say, he was a ne'er-do-well. He hadn't really made his mark. He'd had a series of jobs. There's a list.
They were dredging for gold, his family. They had a gold mine operation that failed. They did, you know, he went out west when there was the Spanish flu and worked on a ranch as a cowboy. He was itinerant. He really had not clicked at all with anything, but God forbid, you know, he was writing Pulp Fiction. That was shameful.
Well, it's true. And Stan Lee changed his name too. You know, I guess there was really nothing worse than being a writer, I guess. There's nothing worse. So, But and this amazing success that he had with these two characters, and it transformed his life. And it's funny, this if you look at Tarzan, the first edition, this is not a guy that was an expert on Africa. This is not a guy that was like Kipling, who had gone to on a great adventure in his life and was writing stories about exotic lands. And that was reflected in the fact that Burroughs put a tiger in Tarzan. And of course, there are no tigers in Africa. They're native to Asia. And in subsequent printings, they fixed the error. But I'd always thought that was kind of amusing that this guy in Ohio didn't know enough about the Dark Continent to know that there was no tigers.
He'd never been to Mars either.
He'd never been to Mars and wrote about that like he had. I mean, that's crazy. And, you know, I think there's something, if you think about Cincinnati, also the home of the Cincinnati Bengals, Tigers. Also, there must be something going on in the Ohio school system about the big cats of other countries, because they got to work on that. But huge success. Burroughs' character made it onto the screen. Tarzan made it on the screen in a matter of years. I mean, I believe it debuted in 1912, and by 1918, it was on the big screen with Elmo Lincoln. For you, Michael, what's of the Tarzans through the years, is there one that you kind of that resonated for you, or that you least think of, if you like it or don't like it?
Well, even now with all these Sherlock Holmeses, the first one that springs to mind is the one when I was a child, which is watching the old Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes movies. And in the same way, even though I watched the TV series with Ron Ely, the first one that springs to mind is clearly Johnny Weissmuller and Me, Tarzan, You, Jane, which is pretty divorced from the novels, but that's Tarzan. That's the one that sent it into the stratosphere in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's fitting during this Olympics time to touch base with one of our first celebrity Olympians.
Far the greatest Olympic athlete turned movie star. I mean, you know, Jim Cotta is not going to cut it. Has there ever been another Olympian, certainly an Olympic medalist, who went on to a successful acting career like Johnny Weissmuller did? I don't think there's anybody even close. Oh, Bruce Jenner. Yeah, Bruce Jenner, had a career.
Mary Lou Retton had one movie I know of. And Jim Thorpe.
Oh, yes. But nobody had a good career. No, but Johnny Weissmuller had a substantial career. He was in Tarzan for a dozen plus movies. And then he said, I'm getting too old to wear the loincloth. But that didn't stop him from immediately becoming Jungle Jim and getting to wear a full outfit like an adult and move on and make a bunch more movies. So,
but yeah, it's amazing. Also, just sort of the flexibility that audiences had back then. I mean, and you look at Buster Crabbe playing Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers. Like, he's not just... I mean, he's both guys, like, and they didn't seem to mind at all.
And I always have trouble telling them apart. I really did.
Flash is the one with the blonde dye. That's just remember Flashy. Not only was he the iconic defining Tarzan, but he still echoes today quite literally with his trademark yell, which has been consistently used throughout the years by most every subsequent Tarzan, and actually is also trademarked. There's a trademark number for that yell.
For that piece of audio?
Yeah, which is fantastic. I don't know if Carol Burnett knows that. But
yes, Carol Burnett famously in her show would do a Tarzan yell as well. Quite a credible one too.
Yeah, and Tarzan, he's been such he was a central character in American pop culture. Edgar Rice Burroughs was the Stephen King of the first half of the 20th century. I mean, as far as sort of a American popular writer with his sales, he was right at the top as far as the number of books sold for American authors in that half of the 20th century. And
much bigger than, say, Conan did.
That's right. But bigger than Robert E. Howard. And because of the films and the comic strip, you know, which, you know, with Hal Foster and Gray Morrow and all the amazing comic books and then later animation, Burroughs himself wanted, he was thinking about animation very early on. In the 20s, he was saying he thought Tarzan would be ideal as an animated character. And after seeing Disney's success. He said, Walt Disney, that's what, you know, we need to look at for Tarzan. It would only take, you know, several, what?
60 years.
60 years before that came to fruition.
So let's stop here. He wrote the Tarzan novel, massive success, and a very smart entrepreneur. Within 15, 18 years, he founded a company and started self-publishing his books so that he could make all the profits. And he also said, I want to put Tarzan into a comic strip. I want to put Tarzan onto the radio. And people said, no, that's crazy. You can't do it in all these different areas because people will get sick of it or they won't know which one is the real one. And I don't know if he's the actual first to innovate that, but according to some, he said no, he pushed it through, and he had it, and all, and they just fed one another. Tarzan on the radio made you want to read the Tarzan comic strip. Tarzan comic strip made you want to read the books, and then the books made you want to see the movies, and the movies started it all over again.
And then finally, you're in Tarzan Beyond Tarzanverse. You know, you're going to have multiple Tarzans on screen.
You're in literally Tarzana. So successful a character that he bought a ranch, named it Tarzana. The town grew up around it. And they officially incorporated themselves as Tarzana, California. He is buried in a place named after the character that, you know, lives on today, Tarzan, Tarzana, California. That's crazy.
That is crazy. And even crazier is the fact that Tarzana has little or no Tarzan stuff in it. I mean, you could if you go to Metropolis in the Midwest, they have like a Superman
festival. They have a statue,
statue,
right?
Statue and yeah. Stores and murals. If you go up they have a place in Star Trek place
oh,
in
yes.
Canada.
Yeah.
I can't think of the name of it, right?
It's after the town where he was born, right?
Yeah. If you go up there, they have Star Trek stuff left and right. They celebrate it with their culture and everything like that, their local activities. But in Tarzana, California, there's not a vine to swing on. There's nothing. There's no Tarzan Museum. There's no Tarzan Gift Center, which is really interesting.
James T. Kirk was born in Riverside, Iowa. Is that where it is?
No. There's a place.
Or is it for Gene Roddenberry?
No, it's a place. It's not Vulcan, Canada, but it's like, I'll think of it. Hold on one second. I'm turning to our team of researchers. And they got nothing. It'll show up.
No, I believe it is Vulcan, as the team researcher who was Googling.
Vulcan.
Is in Alberta and is recognized as the official Star Trek capital of Canada. A title for which there was probably very fierce competition.
Well, I'll tell you, the Horta Canada is really disappointed that their bid to be
Tribbles Ontario is furious.
Lake Tribble, yeah, exactly.
Well, let's start with the book because that's where it all began. Have you read the book?
I have. It's been many, many years, but I did read the book.
Do you remember what you thought? Because I was surprised at how good the book was and how different it was from the movies that I knew.
Yeah, I thought it was good too. I read it as a teenager, and I found a lot to like in it. The portrayal of natives, which are often described as cannibals, ignorant cannibals, or
that he loves killing,
and he enjoys tormenting, and that he's inherently superior to them, largely because of his breeding, his stock, and
not just, you know, that he's white, but that he's a elite upper class white. I mean, yeah. It's double eugenicist.
Yes, exactly. And later, you know, he probably would have been a Nazi supporter, except he just hated Germans so much because he was such a Anglo-Saxon guy. The book, I think it's surprisingly well written. Yes. Considering he was 37 years old and again on his like 12th career and seemingly had no predisposition toward this.
He hadn't written a word. It wasn't like he was a hack writer like me and then suddenly decided to write a book and maybe you'd have a facility because you've written so much. You can sort of put words together. It may not be good, but by God, I could write a book in an hour. It just would be crap. But he, from doing nothing, we don't know that he even read much. And
all
suddenly,
we know is that he had pencils and they were sharpened.
And they were very sharp. The book, the Edgar Rice Burroughs is deeply racist. I mean, even by the tenor of the times where there was eugenics and there were people who were progressive and liberal who thought eugenics was a good thing. And then there were people on the far right who pushed it into an even uglier level of the Nazism. This guy was super racist. He was like, we should kill off all criminals and kill off people who have poor genes. And that's how we'll create a new race, which is his big nonfiction treatise. He's very, very racist. The first Tarzan book transcends that to a degree. The movies are worse in many ways. The books become incredibly trite as you go on. The first book is really quite good if you don't mind a little racism. The second book, The Return of Tarzan, is good. The third book, The Beast of Tarzan, is and they really slide down after that. In contrast, the John Carter books, the first one, A Princess of Mars, is almost incompetent. It's right. Terrible. The second one is okay, The Gods of Mars. And the third one is pretty good. It never gets more than pretty good, but they were hugely successful as well. The Tarzan books remain hugely successful, but his one moment of true inspiration, really, he applied himself and he did a great job, is that first book, Tarzan of the Apes.
Yeah, it really, really is. And it's fascinating how many words this guy had in him. Again, I mean, to start at age 37, and not only, I mean, there would be 22 Tarzan books in all, I think, and the Barsoom books, the Martian books, the Time That Land Forgot stuff, and some other things.
The Hollow Earth books, the Earth That's is right. Hollow, you can go to the Earth, the At the Earth's Core was his first book like that. Yeah, he's got all sorts of books, you know, he's spinning them out.
And then he also had like an interesting career as sort of a citizen celebrity journalist in a way. You know, I mean, he covered the Hearst papers, hired him to cover a kidnapping trial in the 1940s. And that's when, for instance, it really sort of revealed his racism, I think, on a new level, because that's when he started opining about morally inferior
races
and things like that. And that, I think that's when.
It ain't subtle.
Yeah, it's a lot less subtle than the Tarzan book, the first Tarzan book. And then an interesting twist is that he also ended up being, in his 60s, a war correspondent. He became a celebrity war correspondent covering the Pacific Theater for the Los Angeles Times.
I'd love to read what he said about the Japanese. I'm sure it was perfectly subtle and, you know, nuanced.
That's why he didn't want to go to Europe and get a little murky there. He wanted to keep things nice and clear. So we're talking about him today, not because we think he's great, but because we think that it's worth talking about these things that are part of pop culture and that are.
But why are we drawn to this? Now, the first fear is that there's some inherent racism, and we just love the idea of a white man being able to be superior to everybody else. Even if you drop us in the middle of the jungle, by God, we will go to the top of the pyramid. You can't help feeling that a little bit. It's certainly rooted in some of its appeal. However, when you look at cultures all over the world and you read mythology and folk tales and legends and the stories that are told, the feral child is always a big one in all cultures. The idea of a child raised by animals, and also the idea of a child raised by animals and thriving and not just becoming animal-like, but becoming human and almost superior human, but surviving and thriving in that new culture and then coming back to society. You see that all over the world. So it's not something rooted in just Western Anglo-Saxon male racism, racist, you know, fantasies. There's something appealing about a human dropped into nature, raised by other animals, and coming to life. Of course, one of the more famous ones is The Jungle Book, which is not nearly as racist as you might think, given the reputation of Rudyard Kipling. And he recognized that Tarzan was really The Jungle Book grown up, The Jungle Book amped up to 1,000, The Jungle Book turned into Raiders of the Lost Ark. And he said, he took my story and he ran with it. And he was sort of admiring of it, even though he never saw the movies. He did read that book and think, well, it's not a great book, he thought, but, you know, by God, he made a lot of it.
Yeah, exactly. And there is, I think, a lot of it is sort of serving the audience's perspective. I mean, I think, you're supposed to feel like, what would it be like to be this kid grow up in the jungle and stuff like that? Of course, although you know deep down, you wouldn't ever be Tarzan because
you'd be dead.
you'd be dead. It is a fascinating character in some of the iterations, the portrayal of Jane through the years. I mean, look at the actresses that have played Jane. I mean, you've had O'Sullivan.
Marina O'Sullivan.
Mia Pharaoh's mother. You also have Minnie Driver, and you have Margot Robbie, and you have Bo Derek.
Who got top billing. Bo Derek gets top billing. Richard Harris is second, and poor Tarzan is ranked third in Tarzan the Ape Man from 1981. Probably the worst Tarzan of all time?
Oh, sure.
I mean, I don't know. No. I saw the Casper Van Dien, and there's a lot. That's truly dreadful. There's a lot of bad Tarzans. I don't know if there's anything redeeming in Tarzan the Ape Man other than, if you like it, Bo Derek.
What do we think about the most recent one? Did you see the David Yates?
The Alexander Skarsgård film?
That's correct.
No, I have not seen it. That's from 2016, The Legend of Tarzan. I was wondering if you did. How was it?
You know, I saw it, and I can't remember a thing.
I can't remember Tarzan the Lost City, except I wanted to see Casper Van Dien as Tarzan. God forgive me.
I want to see Margot Robbie.
Exactly. I like Starship Troopers. And that is one primal appeal of Tarzan, not homoeroticism, but just that sex appeal and that strength of being in the jungle and a warrior. Tarzan the Ape Man from 1932 was a huge hit. And then the peak Johnny Weissmuller film, I think, is Tarzan and His Mate from 1934 with him and Maureen O'Sullivan. She goes skinny dipping in the nude. It's pre-code. You see her naked in the water. You see it and you're like, wait, what? Did I just see that? She's in a tent and she's silhouetted while she's changing. You're like, I can see everything. Oh my God. And they have this sexual chemistry and you know that they're having sex. Tarzan and Jane are absolutely having sex. And she's a single woman at the time, though they sort of cover it up. And so that, you know, you're in the jungle, you're alone, you're with a woman, and by God, you're the only two people in the world. And that sexiness, that appeal is very, very strong. That's why you have Bo Derek. That's why you have all these hunky actors who tackle Tarzan, because there's something really, really primally exciting by the idea of just being the lord of the jungle.
Sure, absolutely. And then for me growing up, I watched the Weissmuller and movies and enjoyed them, but for me it was the Ron Ely, you know, just the one that would show on Saturdays. It aired originally in the 60s, and I saw the reruns in the late 70s and the 80s, there was something about him. He was just so charismatic, and just like this, he's this big, handsome, strapping guy running around. But he was very egalitarian and very decent. And he didn't.
The Tarzan, other than their racism, they're very egalitarian, other than their hatred of black people, which is a problem when you're in Africa. They're always siding with the weaker guy. It's not just that they have a code of honor. It's like, no, they are always defending the weak and defending the weak and respectful of women. Even in the books, he's not raping women, even though the opportunity presents itself. Right. So that's kind of interesting. But Ron Ely, that series began in 1966, the year I was born, ran for 3 years, 66 to 68. Maybe that's just 2 seasons. And I just recall him. He's Tarzan. He's in the loincloth, but he's like the fully developed. Hey, how you doing, Tarzan? Yeah. Right? He just seems like a guy who's hanging out in the woods.
Yeah, he seems like a lost beach boy. Like he could have been one of the Beach Boys. He's got these dimples and he's always clean shaven and he's very polite and he's got perfect. He doesn't have any sort of guttural sound to him. He's not like me, Jane.
Which is true to the book. The book, he educates himself. He can pick up a language like that. Ultimately, in the books, he becomes immortal. They take some magical pill that makes him and Jane and Boy and others to be immortal. It's just crazy. You know, the books become bizarrely bad. He's constantly stumbling across lost civilizations.
Yeah, all the time.
Every other minute, there's a new civilization. But I mean, the Ron Ely character is really well-educated, and he just got sick of civilization and returned to the jungle, which is indeed part of the story of the original Tarzan books. You know, he tries civilization, says, no, and this is not for me. Absolutely. And it was filmed in Brazil, unlike some of the first movies. It was not filmed in a studio backlot. I mean, Tarzan was filmed in Sherwood Forest. Talk about head spinning. Some of Tarzan was filmed in Sherwood Forest, the first 1932 film. And they planned to go on location for the second movie because it was such a big hit, but it didn't happen. But the TV series was filmed in Brazil.
And then Mexico. It showed in the extras and the natives and stuff. It was very confusing because the people didn't look African often on the Ron Ely show. There was also an episode, if I'm not mistaken, that had Diana Ross and Supremes. as nuns.
Really? There was no boy or Jane, right? Or no?
There was a kid that was always around, but it wasn't his kid. Yeah, no Jane. Good. She curves his style. But the Diana Ross and the Supremes, I think, came through. Unless it was a false syrup dream.
Well, it was one of the animated series.
Oh, I liked the animated series a lot when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to tell you a funny story. I interviewed Ron Ely at the Paley Center. Now,
what was the occasion?
It was just part of their series of looking back on classic television, and he was in town, and they asked if I would come do an interview with him, and I said yes. I was very excited to do it just because I enjoyed the show so much as a kid. He was at the Paley Center in Los Angeles, the museum for television. And they asked if I would come interview him, and I jumped at the chance because I enjoyed the show so much. And I have to say, he's just as charming and nice as he could be, just a really thoughtful guy. And he said that early in his career, he didn't really enjoy the fans. And he's a private guy, and he's a very athletic guy. He didn't really understand the fan culture as it was, especially at that time. It wasn't as organized as it is now. But later, he came to really love it. And by the time I talked to him, and this is, you know, probably about 6-7 years ago, he was really, really enjoying it quite a lot. And I asked him, I said, "What, you know, I have to say, I see you on this TV show and you're running around, and I noticed you have no shoes on. There's no socks, not a shirt. Do you think that's wise? I mean, don't you think that these fights that you get in with like crocodiles and spear men, don't you think they probably go a lot better if maybe you wore a tunic or like, shoes?" And he's laughing. He's like, "You know, clearly it would have made things easier, but somehow they think that it just would speak to the tradition of Tarzan." But if you ever watch the show, and it's worth going on YouTube just to look at, you know, the opening credits are on there, and you might find an episode or two. But he would just fight these animals, and they would show it on the show. And that's what I remember most, is him just rolling around on the ground fighting these wild animals. And I couldn't understand how on earth he wasn't killed. And I asked him what, because he fought all manner of beasts. I'm sure that, you know, PETA wasn't around, and the SPCA wasn't looking. But in Brazil in the 60s, I'm sure that there was probably, you could fight animals for money. But I don't know. But I asked him what the hardest one was. And he said, by far, it was a tiger. He said, because if you fight a bear, and at this point he puts his hands above his head in like claws, and he starts swinging them down toward in front of him like he's a bear. He's like, "Bear will attack you like this, swat at you. And, you know, a lion will just try to bite you and, you know, put its hands on your shoulders. But a tiger," and at this point he puts both his hands in front of him, but his palms are facing out, so he looks like he's swimming. And he puts him about chest level, and he starts digging sideways like a gopher. He goes, "This is what a tiger does. Its claws come in at the center, and they try to tear you open." And I said, what do you do when that happens?" He goes, "You don't let that happen." And I said, "Well, what do you do?" And he said, "You just don't let that happen." And it was one of my favorite things. It was one of the most educational interviews I ever had, because I feel like I just know now, when a tiger's coming at me, I know exactly how it's going to kill me. I know exactly how death will arrive.
Ron Ely, of course, also played Doc Savage in Doc Savage, Man of Bronze, another famous, famous Pulp Fiction hero that didn't catch on in the movies the way Tarzan did.
No, it was a template for Superman in some ways. I mean, the Man of Bronze instead of the Man of Steel. He dated a journalist, named Margot Lane, and he was kind of a elevated, you know, intellect, man of tomorrow kind of.
I don't think I was fancied Ron Ely, but I certainly thought, wow, I'm enjoying this show as a kid. I was like, yeah, it's a good show. I like this show. It's worth watching week after week. I don't know.
He's cheerful.
But we're talking about the movies and the TV show because the books just don't hold up that much. Once you get past the first book, it's a lot of junk. The John Carter books really don't hold up either. I don't know if you disagree.
No, I agree with you, but I think that movie's underrated. I think that movie is actually not nearly as bad as people think. Mm-hmm. I actually enjoyed that movie.
And I like Friday Night Lights, so I'm happy to support any cast member of Friday Night Nights in anything. So that I was excited for it. I was really rooting for him. Plus, I love the Pixar. So that's a heartbreaker. That's for sure. But absolutely. You're starting with a Civil War hero from the other side. It's a hard lift.
It's a hard sell. Like,
he's not making it easy for anybody. He's like, my hero is on the South.
and also, you know, we've seen Mars now. Like we sent a Martian rover there. It's like, we see pictures. We're like, no, it doesn't look like that.
Where are all the crazy people?
Amazing how much stuff got ripped off from John Carter, though. I mean, to have they have mystic warrior priest named Jeddah. Mm-hmm. Like, come on, George Lucas. At least change it up a little bit, you know, like, and he leaps
Superman,
like Superman before Superman was flying, things like that.
Well, you know, there were books, obviously, and then there were comic strips, which you mentioned briefly, but right away they launched a comic strip and top-notch quality. It was illustrated by Hal Foster, who went on to do Prince Valiant, one of the great comic books of all time, and he did a great job with these comic strips. You can find collections of them. If you look at them, they're just gorgeous. They're just beautifully illustrated.
Absolutely beautifully, beautifully done. And Byrne Hogarth, also, you know, one of the just the tremendous artists, and you know, known for his meticulous depiction of anatomy. He did a famous series of anatomy books for artists, in fact, and. In the comics, in the comic books, everybody did different versions of Tarzan along the way. DC did it in the 60s and 70s, and Marvel in the 70s. The DC one is a particular note with Joe Kubert's art. Joe Kubert, who was the great DC artist on Sergeant Rock and Unknown Soldier, and so many of the great things that all the war titles he really left his imprint on. And Tarzan was one of his signature works, I think. His ragged and rough style looked really tremendous in these primordial settings.
But the books aren't particularly well thought of, are they? Those comic book runs? It's just the artwork. And there was even a Japanese manga created by Osamu Tezuka, the guy who created Astro Boy, and he's the godfather of manga. That's back from 1948. So you have the great comic strips, you have the great manga, I believe, at least its reputation. Yeah. So then really, since 1996, the Tarzan comic books went to Dark Horse. Right. And they're still ongoing today. Are they well thought of? Are they any good?
Yeah, they're generally well regarded. They haven't really sort of lit it up with an audience, but I think that, you know, they definitely have they definitely have taken the reader on a good adventure. I mean, there's good stuff there.
So you've got good quality. You can take a character, you can throw them into all these other media, but it's not going to work if you don't do a good job. There were radio shows that were hits. I've never listened to them. There's the comic strip, which was beautifully illustrated. And you have the movies from the silent era, none of which I've seen other than a clip or two. And then when you have the live action one, I mean, the sound era with Johnny Weissmuller, hugely successful, ended up being B movies. They were big budgets at first, but, you know, very successful movies for sure. So that really helps keep it alive. Even when the original books by Edgar Rice Burroughs fell out of print, they were still making movies and TV shows, that's for sure.
Absolutely. And merchandise, you know, toys through different generations. The Mego toys in the 70s, late 60s and 70s were really great.
But certainly a nadir is when you hit Tarzan the Ape Man in 1981 with Bo Derek, with Jane getting top billing over Tarzan. Not good. And then you have the most tantalizing, the most promising and heartbreaking version of Tarzan that there has ever been, which is 1984's Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes. You know you're in serious territory when you have both a colon and a comma. You have a long, they're not messing around. Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes. They really went for it. And this movie has a legendary script. It goes back to the novel, that original novel, which is, it does, yeah. Yeah. Very, very well thought of. It goes back to the original novel and the roots of Tarzan, and does it better than any other Tarzan movie had before. And half of that movie is an absolute stone cold masterpiece. It's so good. And then they come to England and it all falls apart. It's Christopher Lambert from Highlander. It's beautifully done, and then it just goes off a cliff. It's really sad. If you watch half that movie, you're going to see the story of Tarzan told as good as it ever has been.
It's interesting because I think the David Yates movie spent too much time in civilization as well, or not in civilization, but with him post formation. I mean, he's not, you know, it's not an origin story, you know, per se. They show it in fleeting scenes, but really, I mean, it's more about him after he's already famous as Tarzan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Greystoke is heartbreaking because it really was, and you had Madeline Stowe as his love interest. They end up, because, is it Madeline Stowe, right?
Minnie Driver. Oh, Madeline Stowe.
Yeah, right? And they end up dubbing her voice with Glenn Close because she couldn't do the British accent.
Wow, I didn't realize that. So Glenn Close was also in the Tarzan, the Disney one.
That's so right.
She's the double dipper. I had no idea.
Yeah, so Greystoke is a heartbreaker for a lot of reasons. But maybe it's not Madeline Stowe, but it's what's
Minnie Driver, wasn't it? No?
Look it up.
I'm looking it up and it says Andy McDowell.
Andy McDowell is what I wanted to say. I knew it was the woman from Four Weddings and a Funeral. Andy McDowell just has an inherently Southern accent. And after they filmed the whole movie, they decided this doesn't work. And they dubbed her entire character with the voice of Glenn Close, which is a nightmare.
And to think, I mean, Ralph Richardson, Ian Holm, I mean, there's some talent.
And Christopher Lambert is a great Tarzan. He does a great job. He's really good in Highlander, but he's magnificent in this movie. He really, but you know, it's a screenplay by Robert Towne. It's Hugh Hudson coming off Chariots of Fire. They had every opportunity to make a great movie. It's, how long is it? It's 2 hours and 10 minutes, though I think the original cut is like 2.5 hours or 3 hours, if they told it right. They just did too much. They went to the civilization, which is not a good idea. They should have just stopped in the jungle. You don't need, or spent 20 minutes in civilization and head right back again. It was a shame.
It is a shame. And the Glenn Close connection, she, in the Disney one, she was Kala, who is the adoptive ape mother of Tarzan. So she went from Jane to Kala.
Well, I have a list of every favorite movie from every year, and there are only two Tarzan movies on it. In 1934, I have Tarzan and His Mate. And in 1999, I have the Disney version of Tarzan, which I think is probably the best version of Tarzan in many ways. I think it's just sensational. Good score by Phil Collins, great drum-oriented score. You'll Be in My Heart is fine. Okay. Oscar-winning song, but the score is terrific. The action is terrific. The voice work by Tony Goldwyn and Minnie Driver is terrific. It's a great story. And they have a very interesting way of avoiding the inherent racism of the books. What did they do?
There's no black people. There's no Africans. there's no Africans at all.
Disney thing to do.
The only people that live in Africa. No people live in Africa. There are no people in Africa. Did we say there's no people? There's no people in Africa. And
yeah, I think it's even in the opening narration sung by Phil Collins that it's a quote, paradise untouched by man.
thanks, Phil.
But that did solve a problem of how they were going to present and tell that story. And I have to say, the movie that's there is really good. What puzzles me about it was a huge worldwide success. They did some innovation in the animation to make it really move. That worked really well. It was great. Why did they not make a sequel for the movies? They made two crappy straight-to-video sequels, two pieces of junk that have gotten poor reviews. And this, if ever a Disney film should have had a sequel, this is it.
I think that it had to do with the Burroughs family the deal with Disney, because they still own, the trademark is still, active, and the Burroughs, you know, estate at that time was still controlling things. And I think the licensing deal that they
was for just one movie. That's bizarre.
Yeah, I think so.
And but you know, Disney really is, I beg your pardon, Disney in general with their animated movies didn't make sequels. Even with Pixar, they didn't make sequels for quite a while. It was just not the game. They did start doing some direct-to-video sequels. Absolutely. That became more and more common, like Aladdin. And of course, Toy Story 2 was supposed to be straight-to-video. And they said, this is actually quite good.
Yeah.
But Tarzan cost $130 million to make. It grossed $450 million worldwide. Plus, so that's a rock-solid, you know, hit. You've tripled your budget, and more than tripled your budget. And of course, all the ancillary stuff.
Yeah, Tarzan's Treehouse at Disneyland.
And then unfortunately, Tarzan the Musical on Broadway, exactly. Which opened and closed within a year.
Did you say Glenn Close? Did you say Glenn Close? No, you said open and closed. She's in it again. No. I think the Disney didn't double dip because of the deal with...
It was too prohibitive.
Yeah, there's something about it that one side or the other just didn't go for it.
That was a mistake by the estate. How stupid. You finally had a good Tarzan movie for the first time in decades. A commercially successful, good movie that would have kept the name alive in a really vibrant, the way it's fallen off a map since then. What's happened since then? Nothing.
Oh, yeah, no, nothing. You know, one of the great aspects of that film actually was, as you mentioned, was the movement. You know, they did some motion capture stuff that allowed them to, or I should say, I'm not sure if it's motion capture per se, but it was motion presentation of almost like skating.
Yes, well, almost like skateboarding, unfortunately. Skateboarding, yeah.
And just the movements and also the physiology of the main character, the way he looked, and he had sort of a lupine kind of build, and just the way he moved and stuff. I thought it was really, really successful and very different. We hadn't seen that before in a Tarzan movie.
And great voice work. You know, Tony Goldwyn, Minnie Driver, Glenn Close, etc. They all did really good voice work. So it's a really well-performed film, which you don't always get with Tarzan. I should point out, they did spin it off into a TV series. I was probably on the Disney.
I remember that. I remember I was a devotee of that. Yeah.
Is it good? It ran for 2 seasons and 39 episodes. It's probably pretty expensive, so that doesn't mean much. Did it run on Disney Channel, or where did it air?
It did.
I think I watched it on Disney Channel on TV. And it was also compiled into one of the direct-to-DVD sequels, because I had that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember it was really interesting, because it was very kind of sword and sorcery, in that you go to adventures with them to lost temples and meet, you know, priestesses and whatever.
Did you love Tantor, the germophobic red elephant?
Not particularly.
Professor Archimedes Q. Porter. That's Jane's father. Like, that's Jane's father, I guess.
Wow.
She had Jane like in the jungle and her dad, and they're all living in Tarzan's treehouse.
Yeah, yeah.
Very. And Kayla, a female gorilla who's his adoptive mother. A wisecracking female gorilla. And Tarzan's adoptive cousin. I'm glad they're recognizing blended families.
It's considered by many people to be one of the more successful film to TV animated adaptations in the Disney library, along with Buzz Lightyear. A lot of people consider that one to be one of the peaks of a not watered down version.
And Toy Story 2 also came out in 1999, the same year of Tarzan.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, for Disney, I mean, the great promise of Tarzan was that it would help sell toys to boys. One of the things that brings up now is, you know, this most recent Tarzan film did not get any traction at all, really, despite having a director who had just done 4 Harry Potter films. And, you know, Margot Robbie, who's one of the hottest young actresses in Hollywood. And you have to wonder about the future of the character, especially post Wakanda. I mean, the King of the Jungle now is Black Panther, and it's pretty hard to go back to Tarzan once Black Panther's been on the scene. So even with that character in semi-retirement, I would think, for a good long time. I mean, they've said that they're not going to recast since the death of Chadwick Boseman. But I think that the legacy of that character and the shadow he casts, I don't think we're going to see Tarzan, George of the Jungle, or the Phantom anytime soon, any of the white jungle guys.
I would love to see a crossover between Tarzan and Black Panther, where like Tarzan is some sort of, you know, Wakandans view him as like some sort of like, oh, we're not going to engage. He's one of those, you know, primitive tribes that we just have a non-engagement policy. He's like their equivalent of North Sentinel Island.
Yeah, he thinks he's got all these powers, and really it's just them with their technology making him feel good. They're worried that he's going to hurt himself running around the jungle. I mean, he's sort of the Jake Sully of Africa. Does anybody know from Avatar? Do people know who Jake Sully is? I guess so.
Yes.
No.
Oh, that's the guy from Avatar.
That's the lead guy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He's the one that's like.
We're going to see how those do. Are they going to be Matrix 2, 3, and 4? I wonder.
Yeah,
no, I've never bet against so. Never bet against James Cameron. That's for sure. Not commercially.
It's true. It's true. I think though it's very revealing that, you know, there was a line of toys for Avatar and they never ever sold. Nobody cared at all. Yeah. You say to somebody, name how many Harry Potter characters can you name?
All of them
up to like 20, 30. Name 3 characters in Avatar. Good luck. You know, you turn blue in the face before you can name 4.
I couldn't name 3. I couldn't name 1.
I just told you Jake Sully.
I know, that's it. I had already forgotten the name. So yeah, is Tarzan out of date? You know, the Phantom was a comic strip, of course, and all that stuff. I never thought of the Phantom as translating well, and he never has into any media, really. Maybe it was a radio show I don't know about, but the Phantom has really never really worked. He's got a guy and his wolf running around doing stuff. That never worked.
It's tough on radio because he didn't have a sidekick. I mean, that's why, you know, all the radio characters, Lone Ranger, Green Hornet, they all have sidekicks so they can tell somebody what they're doing.
And the sidekick can be in danger and they can rescue
them. Also, like, look over there, Kimosabi. And I mean, you get all this exposition. Otherwise, Lone Ranger is always muttering to himself, there, up ahead, I see them. There's, you know, it's a lot better if you could just talk to a friend.
So will Tarzan survive? You know they're going to make more Tarzan. You know there will be other Tarzan movies or properties of some sort. They'll rethink it completely, as they've tried to do with Greystoke and some others, to bring it up to modern sensibilities and ignore and get rid of all the colonial aspects of it. Someone can be dropped in the jungle and have to. It's going to be a black Superman. There could be a black Tarzan, or, you know, who knows? You know, so there are ways to deal with it. And it will come back because it's such a primal tale and the name is so powerful. But like you say, right now it feels incredibly dated and out of whack. And yeah, what? White guy, he's in charge, really?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Tarzan actually means white skin. That's actually what the name translates to.
It really does. In what language, or did he just make it up?
He made it up, but I mean, that's what he says it's defined as.
And you know, if you want something better or something that reacts to that, you could, of course, go to the late Charles Saunders, who just died last year. And he was a pioneer of the sword and soul, as opposed to the sword and sorcery genre. He read Conan the Barbarian and said, enough of this. And he created his Imaro novels, I-M-A-R-O. And that's where you have a black hero in Africa, steeped in African mythology, along with Black Panther, really important in terms of sort of reclaiming that stuff and placing them front and center. And by them, I mean the characters of the people who actually live in Africa. So those are really well thought of and well remembered books that have really lasted, and they keep getting reissued. So you can find Imaro, usually came out in 1981, the first book, but they're out there if you want to read something with a fresher perspective.
Now, I was thinking as a final thought, maybe we could, Maya, when you were saying it'd be fun to see him with Black Panther, actually, it really would be pretty fun to see Black Panther and Tarzan. That would be a really great way to rehabilitate Tarzan, and a really interesting way to see the Black Panther character move forward eventually. Although some people would be very happy if we just leave that character with Chadwick forever, and I certainly understand that sentiment and applaud the idea. I'm skeptical that corporate America will find the ability to do that long term.
Aren't there just new leaders of the Wakanda? I mean, don't new people just take power
and take the mantle of the Black Panther in the next phase? But I think that
they're not T'Challa. They're just
exactly. But exactly. So I think that they can do that. But it'd be interesting. Is there any other characters that we've talked about? Some of the older characters, the pre-1950 creations that maybe if we paired them up with a modern character could help them rehabilitate like that. Like I was thinking, we've seen, it's not really an older character, but there's been reports about Harrison Ford's injury on the set of Indiana Jones, the new sequel.
Like the first week. I'm sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but you're like, I shouldn't laugh, but you know, and he's fine, thank goodness. But you're like, Harrison, I pulled my back. You know, that's just the jokes are there.
It's tough. It's tough. It's like a Rolling Stones tour, you know. But it occurred to me, like Captain America and Indiana Jones team up in the 40s would be a great movie if you had like a young. When you recast Indiana Jones and when you recast Captain America, it'd be a great team up because they're both active during World War II and they both owned by Disney. Then they could join the Rocketeer, and you could just have like an old guys, old heroes. I'd go see that. If they put them together with Namor, you have the Invaders, it'd be great.
Well, it's like feeling that Wonder Woman works best in that World War II era, doesn't it? There's characters that belong in that era. You don't want to bring them into the present.
Well, she was World War I in the movie. In the latest
World War One, yeah, yeah.
In the TV show, she was World War II, and then they took her to the big screen, and Patty Jenkins made her World War I, and now 1984 in the most recent one. But you're right, because of, again, there's that sort of aristocratic European tradition of an adventurer, you know. If you look at good guys and bad guys in the old European stuff, I mean, Sherlock Holmes and Dracula, and I mean, these were aristocrats. They didn't have day jobs. They didn't have to work. They were armchair detectives or Transylvanian counts or, you know, the Scarlet Pimpernel or you know, Robinson Crusoe or any of the different...
They seek him here, they seek him there, they seek him everywhere, the damned Pimpernel.
Exactly. There's one. Why didn't that make it to the screen? Well, maybe it's it the did. Scarlet
Leslie Howard.
Pimpernel.
Yeah, Leslie no, Howard.
I mean, but... I mean, like, when did it make it? Why did it make it back to the screen, I should say?
Yeah, I mean, but Leslie Howard bores the living daylights out of me, and his name is Pimpernel.
That's the
just
answer.
Not yeah. going to work. I feel Tom Swift. Tom Swift was just brought onto the... There's a Nancy Drew TV show right now, which apparently has a lot of fantasy in it. Go figure, though that's not Nancy Drew. And there's Tom Swift pops into a special episode as a potential spinoff, and he's a person of color, and he's gay, and he's got issues with his dad. And I'm so ready to watch. I'm like, oh, you know, people, you're trying to, like, some people should just be left alone, you know? Super. Doc Savage, Tarzan, maybe they're best left where they were.
Yeah. Well, any nominations? Anybody have any thoughts? I know it's a weird question, but is there any?
I don't know. I never read Tom Swift, but we got a friend donated us or second handed us a bunch of Tom Swift novels, and I just love the covers.
They're great.
I mean, I think they would be great with a modern sensibility. Like if you know diversify his group of friends and add more women kind of inventors. I mean, that's a huge push is women in STEM. You know, if you add lots of girl geniuses to his group, that would be super fun.
It should in that period.
Yeah.
I don't want to see Tom Swift in 2020 fighting with Tesla, Elon Musk. Yeah. I want to see him back in the 30s.
Yeah. I mean, the aesthetics are just as long as they, I mean, you could obviously, you know, reject some of the quote unquote realities of the period, but if you keep like his giant helmet with the little radar thing on it, and if you keep the bright, you know, cherry red spaceships, that would be so fun. And I mean, the titles are just so compelling. Like my favorite one, I have it still, is Tom Swift in the Caves of Nuclear Fire. Who
who doesn't want to see that?
Especially in an animation, the potential to just go above and beyond and kind of surreal and gangbusters with it would be really fun.
I agree totally. And I love the idea of Tom Swift. I think I read one book. They're not good. There's lots of tiresome, hipster dialogue. And Doc Savage. I've never read a Doc Savage. I saw that movie on HBO from 1975. It's terrible. I have no understanding of why I would care. And yet, I'd like to see a pulpy, the pulp books just have a great appeal. They do have great covers. They have great visuals. They have a great sensibility, that sense of an unexplored world and daring do. It's hard to feel daring do today. You know, like we're worried about a little bug, you know, putting on masks. So it's fun to be back in an era when you can find unexplored continents. And by unexplored, I mean, you know, Africa, I guess.
Yeah. And there's nobody there. We might as well go.
Apparently, it'd be great. Just waiting to be discovered.
The character I'd love to see done right is the Shadow. Yes. The Shadow is, there's some interesting things about the Shadow that, he's of that era. He doesn't have a cheesy costume. You know, he's just got the cool hat, got the scarf.
He doesn't even have any powers. He's just a man about town, Lamont Cranston, who can be very, very quiet. And suddenly, for some reason, nobody can see him.
Well, he's got the sort of, he's learned the ancient Asian mystic tricks of being invisible and sneaking up on people and changing his face and all this other stuff. But I think it'd be great with like a Tom Waits soundtrack. I think it'd be really cool. Shadow meets Batman, base it in the 30s. I'd go see that.
Well, The Shadow is great because it has a great radio series with Orson Welles. You can listen to them on YouTube anytime. And who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows. And he's righting wrongs, and it's It's got, you know, you've got the Saint. They're bringing back the Saint. All these. It's not just that they have name brands, are they? It's not just that, oh, we recognize the name. There's something appealing about the inherent do-gooderism of it, and the fighting crime and yeah, setting the world right that you just yearn for. And I guess they did then too, for the same reason. You know, the world can feel a little chaotic, and when you've got Doc Savage or the Shadow out there, you feel things are going to be okay. Tom Swift can come up with something.
Yeah, and then for Hollywood, I think that boils down to, if not brand memory, at least easily explainable, digestible concepts. And, you know, that's shorthand for, you know, people know what these things are. And you know, if you have a trailer trying to explain The Matrix or trying to explain Avatar, maybe or maybe not, it breaks through. But if it's trying to explain Tarzan or Batman, they assume that people have the sort of, they're tethered to memory and just the general consciousness.
Though to be fair, unless except for us, for most people, you do have to explain who the heck the Shadow is and try and That's forget right. Alec Baldwin. You do have to explain Doc Savage. You sure. do have to explain Tom Swift. You just, it's easier to do when it's a pretty well-built character from the start.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I hope we do see Tarzan again someday, but I think if not, at least I know for me, I learned how to fight a tiger. I know how to fight a tiger. And also there's one other tip I'll leave you guys with too, is that I asked Ron Ely about crocodiles and he said, you don't want to fight them. I said, okay. I made a note of that. And the second thing says, if you are running from a crocodile, I said, okay, this sounds like something I would do. The running.
They're part. Fast. They're fast.
Zigzag. He goes, yeah. Everything in your instinct is going to tell you to go straight because it feels faster, but their little legs, they get lost if they go, if they skitter to the side. So just run zigzag. And I'm like, you're just messing with me, aren't you? Now this is just, this is what
no, because they're people. Fast on the ground. They're fast. Yeah,
they are. And they'll whip the tail around and take you right down.
Lord. All right.
I actually had an alligator encounter on the University of Florida campus, a 5-foot alligator that was, that I killed by accident. I ran over it.
Oh, so it wasn't the one in the lake that would come out every once in a while.
Well, there was that one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was probably in a lake at some point, but it was it was underneath my car trying to stay warm under the engine block. It was like December. I never saw it. I didn't see it until I backed up. I know. I felt terrible.
You have some great shoes.
I have some great luggage. Yes. Yes. I packed my luggage. No.
Oh, that's terrible. That's
terrible. What is wrong with you? I did not. I was going to make the joke. You just beat me too.
No animals were harmed during the making of this podcast.
No. Actually, I ran over an alligator. actually, so we got to check that box off, I think, unfortunately. But it was a long time into making this podcast. But yes, it did include the... I'm sorry. Anyway, it's been really great talking to you about Tarzan. And I hope that you pick a great way to celebrate Edgar Rice Burroughs Day. Let's all meet in Tarzana.
It's September 1st. He was born on September 1st in 1875 or something like that.
His daughter became played Jane in one of the films.
And she married, did on the radio, married, the radio.
Oh, the radio. Forgive me. Yeah. And married the Tarzan.
Yeah.
So his son-in-law was Tarzan.
Living the dream. I mean, your daughter becomes Jane. You live in Tarzana. That's pretty crazy.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And I think I'll go back and check out his war correspondence. Just to see what that's all about, because I think that just sounds nutty. Although you have to admire someone there at, you know, age 66, willing to ship off to the South Pacific to fight the good fight,
or absolutely
read it, write about it. But awesome. Well, welcome back to the jungle always. And Michael, thank you for joining us. We hope you'll join us here again.
Anytime. Maya,
thank you very much. We'll see you guys next time.